CBS Sports NBA podcast. I'm your host, Matt Moore. Today, we're going to talk to Jason Lloyd of the Akron Beacon Journal about LeBron James, where he's at entering the season, how crazy Tuesday's opener is going to be with the Indians hosting World Series Game 1, as well as the Cavaliers ring night, and if the Cavaliers are really going to push as hard as they may have in years past for the number one seed. We'll also talk to Jared Dubin and preview this week's lines for opening night, and we'll talk to Tim Bontemps of the Washington Post about the Golden State Warriors and the circus that surrounds the superstar team. Make sure to check us out on iTunes. Make sure to check us out on Stitcher. Make sure to check us out on SoundCloud. Make sure to check us out at all these places. Leave reviews for us on iTunes. Make sure to subscribe to all the places you can. And let me know of any comments that you have. You can reach me at MattMooreCBS on Twitter. And with that, let's get started with Jason Lloyd of the Akron Beacon Journal. Okay, joining me right now is Jason Lloyd from the Akron Beacon Journal. Jason has been covering the Cavs for a long time. He is a great writer for Ohio.com. His post-game recaps are one of my favorites in the entire league. Jason, how's it going?
I'm great. How are you, Matt?
I'm doing well. Not as well as Cleveland right now, as the city that is so often filled and been synonymous with misery in terms of sports is now rolling with the Indians in the World Series, the Cavs celebrating ring night on Tuesday, two championships in 1 year. Or Cleveland? I mean, are people freaking out? Like, what is going on there in the city right now?
Yeah, people are kind of wandering around with their heads in the sky waiting for a meteor to hit, I think, or trying to rebalance what's going on here. It's a great time to live here, no question about it. Fans deserve this. They've suffered for so long. Everyone knows the history of Cleveland by now, from the fumble, the drive, Red Right 88, all of that stuff, the shot, Jordan tormenting the Cavs for so many years. So, you know, it's great for the city. It's great for the fans. And it's going to be a fantastic week in Cleveland.
Are people more excited about, I mean, obviously they're more excited because the Indians have a chance to actually do something. Is attendance going to be severely impacted on ring night for the Cavaliers for their first championship by the World Series? Is that something that's going to happen?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny because who would have thought that Cleveland waited 52 years for a championship, and now the night to celebrate it has turned into a bit of an afterthought. Everyone's so focused on the World Series right now. You know, I still think it's going to be a packed house. It's still going to be a sellout. You know, I don't think some people, I'm sure, will be fortunate enough to score tickets to both. And, you know, the Cavs moved up the start of everything by a half hour. So, you know, you may get pockets of fans that will show up for the ring ceremony, for the banner raising, and then go across the street to the Indians. But I don't think it'll be, you know, too many people. The tickets are so expensive for both. I highly doubt that there's too many people that can afford tickets to both events and would punt on one game to go see the other. But, you know, I think that the ticket market's going to sort of cannibalize itself because there are two such huge events going on. But certainly the focus right now is on really the Indians more than the Cavs. The Cavs already did it. People had all summer to celebrate it. So now the focus is on whether or not the Indians can do it next. So I think there's certainly more in the crosshairs right now. They're being discussed a little bit more than the Cavs. But obviously everyone still loves the Cavs when, you know, they've made it a point to go to a couple of these playoff games now. And I saw them leaving during the divisional or during the championship series. LeBron got them a suite at the baseball stadium, and they took a freight elevator to and from their suite. And when they were leaving, the way it was set up, there's kind of a catwalk and sort of an overhang in the concourse area. And all the players stopped and sort of waved to the crowd after the game was over. So they were already keyed up because the Indians won. And then the Cavs players, the champions, are hanging over the balcony, sort of waving at everyone. And the way that place shook and shrieked, you thought it was the Beatles. It was incredible watching the reaction that the fans gave the Cavs players. LeBron obviously was there, and Kyrie and Kevin and the rest of them. So this town's really on fire right now.
I'm really curious as to how Cleveland's going to adapt to a new identity of not being, you know, the lovable losers, of not being this town saddled with so much bad history. And I'm interested in how the Cavs are going to take it, because, you know, those feelings when in those cities where that have that tortured history, especially in the playoffs, there's always that lingering, like, hey, things are going well. Please don't blow this. Not again.
Right.
Don't do this to me.
Right.
So I think it'll be interesting to see how that kind of adjusts, but I think we'll have to wait till the playoffs to see if there's any difference there. I did want to ask you, though, you know, going through training camp, they have the title, that huge weight is off of their backs. what's kind of the Cavaliers' attitude right now? Do you expect some kind of championship hangover from what's going to be going on there?
It depends on, I guess, how you want to define hangover. Do I think they're going to start 10-10? No. You know, I think they're going to be a little bit better than that. Could they be? You know, it's been an eventful summer for everything from Iman Shumpert more or less shooting a porn in Kanye's video with the shower scene with his wife to Tristan Thompson running around with the Kardashians. It's been an interesting summer. And, you know, everyone said all the right things in terms of locking back in and getting back to work. But, you know, LeBron was really aggravated with their focus last year and with their attention. And you know, I called them Team ADD last year because as soon as things started to go well, they would sort of take the foot off the gas and lose focus. And it was just a team that thrives in the midst of adversity, and they function amid dysfunction. So that was their identity last year, and it's really pretty much the same team back. So, you know, I don't know what we have to go on to think that it'll be any different. So they've just maybe one of those teams that's the way they're wired. You know, I was joking with David Griffin about it, the GM last year, and you know, he's very much a peace, joy, love guy, and he thinks, you know, he wants everything to be hunky-dory, I guess, and this team it's just not how they operate. They're at their best when their back's against the wall, and it's win or die, and they proved that last year. So, you know, I mean, they won 57 last year. I think they'll probably win realistically around 60 this year. I think they'll improve that win total slightly, but I don't think it's going to be absurd. You know, I don't think we're going to see a Warriors-type leap where they're going to make a run at 70 wins. I don't think that's realistic. Frankly, I don't think they want to do that. You know, Ty Lue has said all along his focus is just be healthy for the playoffs, and that's kind of amusing to me that basketball is the one sport. You know, baseball, everyone plays all 162, and you want to win your division, and there's a reward for that. And football, obviously, there's only 16 games, so every one of them is precious. Basketball, it's like, let's just get there. Let's just get there healthy, and we'll worry about it in April. And, you know, I was talking to Ty the other day about that. I said, is that bad for the sport? And he said, well, you know, I'm not saying we're going to try and skate in as the seventh or the eighth seed, but they're just, you know, it's just the regular season is just a buildup for the postseason. And as long as the Cavs can shoot par on their way to get there, and if they win somewhere between 55 and 60 games and they get the first or the second seed, I think they'll be fine with that.
Yeah, I just can't see them really going hardcore after a really high win total. I mean, it's one of the reasons the under is kind of tempting, just because I think if this team gets second or third seed, even, I think they'd be fine with it. And
they would.
They're so good that you don't expect them to. But my question is, how much is LeBron going to take off? Because I expect him to take off more this season than he has at any point before. I mean, he talked about in training camp, like first week, he was like, "I'm still really tired. I'm still really like my body is not quite ready to get back there." And so, like, I looked at their schedule, you know, after they play the Warriors on Christmas, which obviously I think he'll be around for that game on Christmas just to do the NBA a solid, if nothing else. Like, I wonder if he's just going to take the entire month of January or more off. Like, they don't need him, and it really would give, I think, versus before when it was kind of the throwing the baby in the water to help him teach him how to swim thing. I think now he really can feel more comfortable with saying, Kyrie, take care of business while I go do this. Like, go knock off teams like Milwaukee. Go beat the teams that we should beat even without me. Keep this team afloat, and then I'll be back once my body is right. I've enjoyed the Miami winter, summer sun down there enough. What are you kind of expecting from LeBron this year, being around him and being around his people and what the conversation is around him? Because there are extremes. Like, our own Bill Ryder thinks that he's going to make a serious run at MVP, because the weight is off of him. He's still kind of bothered by the talk about Steph Curry and the Warriors. He's still motivated. And I'm kind of on the other end where I'm like, I just cannot see him caring about regular season accomplishments at any point. For him, it's all about what happens in June now. And I expect him to take all of that time off, which I think will really hurt his voting chances. What are you kind of expecting from LeBron this year?
I don't think he's going to take like a month off. I see what you're saying. I see where you're coming from. He loves this game too much. He loves playing too much. He loves competing too much. And frankly, he's in a good spot physically. And, you know, last year, he won't go into great detail of what he did differently. But, you know, obviously everyone remembers his first year back in Cleveland. He had the back problems. He had to take 2 weeks off. His body just wasn't right. He went on that crazy diet the summer before he came back. And he cut about 10 pounds. And he just was never right physically. well, he changed some things in his exercise and in his diet and whatever else. And he's never gone into great specifics about what he's done, but he more or less has fixed his back, which, you know, I was talking to him a couple weeks ago and I said, back problems normally get worse with age. They don't get better. And he said he's fortunate that he's got people at his disposal, obviously the best in the world, that he can consult with. And whatever rhythm he's found, he thinks he's in a good spot right now. He got the injection last year during the preseason, a back injection, which everyone was like, uh-oh. But they said at the time it was precautionary, that he felt okay. It was at their disposal and they wanted to use it. So he got the injection last year during the preseason. He only played in a couple of preseason games, and he felt fantastic all last year. He kept saying all year long he feels great. And he's in that spot again now. He's still in that window where he really feels good. So I don't think he's going to play 60 games if he's healthy. He's not going to miss 20 some odd games. But he's past the point of putting a lot of emphasis on the regular season. You're right. I agree 1,000% with that. But he does want another MVP. And he kind of made that clear last year. I was talking about it, and I said, you know, kind of where you are, he's what? I think it's now 3 years removed from his last MVP, and he's 32 years old, and he's getting to the point, he's going to be 32 in December, and he's getting to the point where I think it's only Michael Jordan has won multiple, of guys who've won multiple MVPs at this stage of their careers who have gone like 3 or 4 years or more in between. And, you know, once you kind of get out of that rhythm of winning MVPs, it's sort of you're sort of forgotten. But I think he is going to be a legitimate candidate this year, and I'm contradicting everything that I've said previously because I thought his MVP window had closed. But the way that he won that series for them last year, the way that he carried them into Game 7, I think he's going to get some bonus votes based off last year's finals. Plus, you know, I think you're going to see, obviously, Durant and Steph Curry are going to cannibalize each other a little bit on the MVP voting. I don't think either one of them are going to win it this year. We saw, you know, LeBron was punished his first year in Miami when he didn't win the MVP. And he knew that. He knew going there that he probably had cost himself the MVP award. I think you're going to see that this year with Steph and Durant. So, you know, it's sort of a who's left. You know, I could see Russ Westbrook if the Thunder make a charge. I could see him getting a lot of MVP votes. But I think LeBron's going to be right there this year in the discussion. Obviously, you need to mention Kawhi Leonard as well. He finished second last year. But I think LeBron is going to be a strong contender just based off of last year's finals. I think there's going to be a carryover effect with the voting as long as he puts up typical LeBron-type numbers. And, you know, hey, in my mind, I've always thought LeBron was the best player of the league, and that nothing has happened that changed my view of that. I voted him number one 2 years ago for MVP, and everyone thought it was just a hometown vote, and it really wasn't to me. You know, when you talk about value, the Cavs were the worst team in the league the 4 years he was gone. They had the worst cumulative record. And his coming back brought Kevin Love here and really turned everything around. And to me, that's as valuable as anything in the league. So that's why I voted him number one 2 years ago to win it. Obviously, I voted Steph last year and stand by that. Regardless of what happened in the finals, I still think Steph had the best regular season. But obviously, LeBron just dominated the postseason and proved yet again that he is, in my mind at least, still the best player in this game. So I do sort of expect him to make another run as long as his numbers are on par with where they've been in the past, his average numbers, and I think that they will be. And if I had to suspect, I would guess he's going to play in probably 68 to 70 games. I think he will take some games off. He doesn't want to take a lot off if he's healthy, but I think that they will bench him on, you know, some second and back-to-backs, that sort of thing. So I would suspect that he will play around 68 to 70 games, and in my mind, that'll be enough to keep him in the MVP talk.
Yeah, it's a great point about the best season versus the MVP, and people get those two things confused because LeBron ended any sort of conversation, and our Elite 100 list of top 100 players is going up this week, and I wrote the LeBron entry for number one, and that's what I said was, like, the conversation is over for a sizable length of time where,
right,
you know, he has proven without a doubt that he is the best player, because even if the Warriors, I think, were to beat them this year, it took Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, and Kevin Durant to beat LeBron,
right,
James. And then it's like in parentheses and Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love. So like he's kind of like reshifted that in a very permanent kind of state where, you know, the question of, well, is LeBron really the best player in the league anymore? Yes. Like the finals just absolutely ended that question. Speaking of Love. Okay. You know, had the big defensive possession on Steph. People forget he was really good. And I thought in the early on that Raptor series, I thought he was very good versus the Hawks. He had some real playoff moments, struggled in the finals again, came up big at the end and they won the title. Are we going to get through a whole season without Kevin Love trade rumors? Is this finally the one where we're going to get through the whole year without Kevin Love trade rumors?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to Chris Mannix about this a couple weeks ago, and I said, never say never. Everything looks great now, but I've just learned, you never say never, never say it's all over. For right now, that has certainly quieted down. There's no question about it. But, you know, in the middle of that finals, there was still talk that Kevin was gone at the end of the year. So, and it's unfortunate because you're right. He was fantastic. I think he had one bad game against the Raptors. He had one bad shooting game against Toronto, played really well against the Hawks. And had the Thunder finished off the Warriors, I think he would have had I think that would have been a fine matchup for him against the Thunder. It's certainly the Thunder would have been a better matchup for him than the Warriors. The Warriors are the one team in the league that is a miserable matchup for him. That is about the worst team you could put him against. And the Cavs knew that going in. You know, I was talking to people within the franchise in, you know, March that were saying, if it's the Warriors again, what are we going to do with Kevin? Oh my God, that's the one matchup that just really is tough for him. But that doesn't take away, you know, the type of player he is. He is still a very good player. It's just that he just, with the style that the Warriors play, it's just not a good match for him. And he did come up with a big stop at the end, but that's, you know, I would suspect that he's, you know, they're not going to trade him. He is going to be here. Whether or not what's going to come up between now and then, I can't predict. All I can say is never say never, because I've been around long enough to know that as soon as you think something's not going to happen, that's when it will happen. But I think that he does have his comfort zone here finally. I think Ty Lue went a long way in establishing that when he took over last year. They started putting him more at the elbow and running sets that made him more comfortable. You know, David Blatt just had so much going on that he had to worry about, that making Kevin feel comfortable was about the least of his concerns, because David was coaching for his own job all along. And I think he knew that, and obviously that was proven to be true. So Ty, one of the first things he did was try and establish Kevin in his comfort and his fit on this team. And I think he did a good job with that. And, you know, Kevin seems more relaxed this year in the preseason so far than he's been at any point since he's been here. Seems more confident in his role here. So I think it's taken some time, but I think that he's sort of embraced it. Hey, look, he said he wanted to win, and he's backed that up. He's done everything that's been asked of him. He's accepted the smaller role. He swallowed a lot of pride and humility. He's still getting paid. He's still getting his money. It's a lot easier to accept a smaller role when you're still getting your money.
Right.
So he is I won't say he's embraced it, but he's accepted it. He's accepted his role on this team. He knows now where he can go to get the ball. Where his first year here, he flat out admitted it. He said, I'm just kind of filling in the gap. Wherever the hole is around the perimeter, that's just kind of where I'm floating to. Whereas last year, once Ty took over, you know, we saw him inside a little bit more. We saw him getting some touches inside a little bit more. We saw him go into them early a little bit more. And Ty said, hey, listen, and LeBron had said this his first year with Kevin, if he wants the ball inside, he needs to go inside and demand it. And Ty told him that last year after he took over, that, hey, go in there and demand the ball and they'll give it to you. So he is clearly the third option on this team. That's not going to change as long as Kyrie and LeBron are healthy and playing at the level that they are. He will always be the third option. But, you know, he has accepted that because it was proven in June he can win that way. And that goes a long way in getting these guys to accept, you know, a different diminished role than what they've been accustomed to in the past.
Yeah, that's a great point. Especially, you know, it just shows you people really kind of missed how Ty Lue did help that team and the ways that he changed that team's kind of identity and their mentality.
Oh, my God.
The way that he helped things, which is a conversation for another day. I did want to get your thoughts on Tuesday night's game, because banner nights typically go one of two ways. It's a team in its prime that looks ready to go, and they come out and they make a statement, or they come out and they really struggle because of the championship hangover. 2 years ago, a worse Knicks team came in for the debut of the new Big Three Cavs and beat them on opening night. They've got, you know, we don't know what the World Series impact is going to be on the crowd. We don't know what the championship hangover is going to be like for J.R. Smith once he has to put on a shirt. We don't know all of these things. We do know that they're healthy and they're ready to go. The line is 7.5, which is actually lower than what the Warriors are favored over the Spurs as a sign of where things are at right now with Danny Green out. Do you expect any sort of letdown versus the Knicks on opening night, or do you expect more of a statement game?
Well, it's funny. I don't know what to expect, because LeBron pointed out to us a few days ago, he said he's never lost on ring night. He's 2-0 on past ring nights.
True.
yet the Cavs have not won their opener. They're 0-2 with LeBron here. They lost, like you mentioned, with the Knicks and all the emotion that went into that night. They just seemed to run out of gas around the second quarter of that game. And then last year they lost their opener at Chicago when President Obama was in attendance. And they kind of botched an inbound play at the end of the game, and the Bulls won on opening night. So, they haven't had a lot of time together because of JR's contract dispute. The starters have played less than 10 minutes together in the preseason, but I think that there's going to be some rust to knock off in terms of that. I think that they'll perform better than they did against the Knicks 2 years ago because, as LeBron pointed out, those guys didn't even know each other. They were more or less strangers still trying to get to know each other. And at least this team, there is that continuity now where they have been together an extended amount of time. So, and JR could roll out of bed on 3 hours sleep and make 6 threes because he's done it numerous times. The fascinating part to me, and I asked JR about this, the fact that it's the Knicks that are back, and it wasn't a great departure when he left New York. Phil Jackson took some shots at him afterwards, and JR kind of had some hurt feelings over that. And I asked him, I said, is there any sort of, is it a little sweeter for you that they're going to give you a championship ring? JR Smith is a champion, and you're going to get your ring with the Knicks, across the bench looking at you. And he said, no, he's trying to get past that point of vendettas in his life and vengeance and that sort of thing. I don't believe him. I think that it is going to be sweet for him, with all that's been said and written about him, for him to get a championship ring with the Knicks on the other side of the court. I think that's going to be, I think that's a big moment for him. Now, how he is able to bottle that and then go out and play remains to be seen. But, I think that the Cavs will perform better than they did against the Knicks 2 years ago. But I don't know. It's fascinating to see with all the emotion within the city, within this franchise. I don't think they're going to play their best game on opening night, but I expect them to be better than what they were 2 years ago.
Yeah, really interesting situation on opening night for a regular season that's usually so mundane. Opening night in Cleveland is going to be a lot of stuff going on. That's going to be really interesting. Plus, they're playing a super team, according to Derrick Rose, so they got that going for them. Jason Lloyd of Ohio.com. You can follow him and read his great work there. You can follow him on Twitter at Jason Lloyd, 2 L's, ABJ. So it's Jason Lloyd, ABJ, Lloyd with 2 L's. Jason, thanks so much for your time. We're going to check back in with you later in the season. Have a great time on Tuesday night for what should be an absolutely nuts night in Cleveland.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
We'll be right back. Joining me now on CBS Sports NBA podcast, Jared Dubin, who covers the NFL for CBS Sports Digital, but is also a huge hoops head. You can find his work at many places. Where are you writing NBA stuff these days?
I'm sort of all over the place. I've got the podcast. I'm doing stuff at Vice. I'm doing stuff at Fanside. It's new vertical, The Step Back. So I'm a lot of places, and that's just a couple off the top of my head. We're getting some too.
So we're going to talk about the lines. We have lines. We have numbers. I have beautiful, beautiful numbers to discuss for games. And so I'm very excited. Let's get started with the first game. You run Locked On Knicks, the podcast which covers the New York Knicks. Your boys are at the Cleveland Cavaliers for ring night. A couple interesting things here. The Cavs are 0-2 in the LeBron era on opening night, but LeBron is 2-0 on ring night in his career. So some interesting kind of numbers. The Knicks beat them 2 years ago with a worse squad. Surprisingly, the number is all the way up to 9. The Cavaliers are favored by 9 points over the New York Knicks. What do you think about this line?
Yeah, this can sort of go one or two ways. Either the Cavs are going to come out and stomp all over them, and it's going to be like a massive ring night celebration, or it's going to be like a huge letdown because they have at least a one-game version of a championship hangover. And I honestly don't know which way to go, but I feel like it's always a good bet to take LeBron.
Yeah, I mean, you would think so. I think I'm just worried because there's a lot of stuff going on in Cleveland that night. I mean, there is a lot of stuff going on in Cleveland.
So much. The World Series starts that night.
The World Series starts that night. They've got all this stuff. There's going to be a lot of emotion from the first championship in Cleveland. That makes me a little nervous. Like, I think that makes me a little nervous about what they're going to do in this game. I mean, you have to like the matchup, right? Like, LeBron's record against Carmelo is I think, pretty good. Last year, the Cavs were... Let's see, where were they? Cleveland? They were, oh man, they were not good. they were 51-50-2 versus the spread last year. 51-50.
Really?
Yeah. They were worse than Memphis against the spread. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
That's interesting. I feel like they did have a bunch of double digit wins. I guess they probably had a bunch of huge spreads, especially against East teams, because the conference was better in terms of there was more depth, but nobody was close to as good as that Cleveland team. And I feel like it's sort of the same this year.
They finished like plus 0.3 versus the spread. So like the problem was really just like they got way more respect than they deserve given how much like nonsense was constantly going on with that team. So that's kind of interesting. Last year, by the way, New York had the 5th best record against the spread, 44-38. But then all of their numbers were very low because they were terrible. And now, you know, we just don't know what this team's going to look like. Joakim Noah already saying that he feels a step slow defensively. Derrick Rose has been distracted with the trial, obviously.
And not practicing or playing
at all. Brandon Jennings has looked great. Kristaps is still Kristaps. That Kristaps Porzingis Tristan Thompson / Kevin Love matchup is going to be a little interesting. That's going to be like an interesting little wrinkle. Like the only way I can see the Knicks covering the spread is if Kristaps Porzingis has like a really great game in this one.
Yeah, I could see that. Although the one thing he struggled with defensively last year was perimeter-oriented big men. Like he did not do all that well against Kevin Love. Like surprisingly, he did better switching onto LeBron in pick and roll situations than he did just straight up guarding Love. And like Draymond Green also was another guy that ate him up. Like if he cleaned that up, then that could be really good for them and keep them in the game potentially to have it come down to the wire at the end.
This number, by the way, has drifted radically. It was 7.5 like an hour ago. It's 9 now. I'm using 5 dimes because the other sites don't have theirs up. So I know that there's going to be complaints about 5 dimes. Just bear with me. I'm recording this on a Sunday. That's who has the lines up. The game that no one will be watching except the diehards, the Jazz and Blazers. I was shocked when this number first came out because the Blazers were favored by 3.5. Since then, Utah has had injuries. Hayward's out. Favors is a big question mark. Burks is still not expected to play. So the Blazers now are favored by 5.5 over Utah. The money line is Utah plus 185. I'm kind of tempted on that even without Hayward.
And this game is in Utah, right?
No, it's in Portland.
Oh, it's in Portland. I was going to say if it was in Utah, I sort of like that too. But them going on the road without their best player, potentially with Favors limited or not playing, I do feel like in whatever the Rose Garden is called now, the Blazers can sort of take care of business there.
I think if Favors plays, they can win. Straight up. Like I think I look at it and you say, all right, Dame's the best player in this game, no doubt. Right. But then it gets really dicey. I think after that, because you say C.J. McCollum, and I'd say I think Rodney Hood's right there. I think Rodney Hood is right there with C.J. McCollum.
Rodney Hood's really good.
And then after that, though, like Al-Farouq Aminu is probably the third best player on the Blazers. And then, you know, with the Jazz, you go down and you're like, all right, you know, Derek Favors, Rudy Gobert, you know, Dante Exum, George Hill. Good player that's going to make them better, Joe Johnson. Like, they have real guys that are going to be able to contribute versus Portland. I'm like, if Dame and CJ just have an off night, like, that's it. Like, that's really all their offense is, even as good as Stotts has made them. So, I don't know. I think I'm going to take Utah here. I think I'm going to take Utah plus 5.5 for sure. I like the money line at plus 185 as well.
Yeah, I'm more worried about the Blazers defensively than offensively. Mm-hmm. You know, they basically played defense for a month last season. And other than that, we're pretty bad on that side of the floor. But Utah, you know, without Hayward, I'm not sure how much of a big defensive test they are. Like, I think they're going to be better off offensively this year because of the guys they added. But a lot of that sort of depends on Hayward being the guy.
Yeah.
You know, if you have George Hill playing more of a spot-up role than someone who's going to be initiating the offense a bunch, like if you have Diao and Johnson as supplementary players off the bench – it all sort of revolves around Hayward playing that centrifugal force role for their offense, especially when Favors and Gobert play together. They haven't really scored all that well. And without Hayward, I feel like that could mess them up a little bit. I'm not as confident in Portland for the season as I am in Utah, but I do kind of like them in this opener.
And then finally, the big one, the San Antonio Spurs. Tim Duncan retired, Boris Diaw gone, Danny Green out with an injury. The Warriors are favored by 9 in this game over the 67-win San Antonio Spurs from last season. It's hard to argue. The problem with the Warriors is that their point differential is so high. The Spurs are either going to like somehow win this game or they're going to get blown out by 20. And you kind of have to think at Oracle in Kevin Durant's debut, they're going to bring it. It's a high line. I hate going against the Spurs by that big of a spread, but I don't see... I have real concerns about where Kawhi Leonard is going to take them, about can he really be the guy that's going to lift them up, and when he's the focal point and the only focal point and the real concern, even with as good as LaMarcus Aldridge is and Pau Gasol, you know, how is that going to operate? Now, he was really good last year with Tim Duncan in a diminished role. It feels different to me with Duncan gone. That leadership role does kind of change the dynamics. I think I like the Warriors, but man, that number is high.
Yeah, it's really high, but I also can't see myself recommending going against the Warriors at basically any point of this season. It just feels like doing something dirty and wrong. The thing that really worries me in this game in particular is San Antonio's perimeter defense. You know, Danny Green and Kawhi might be the best perimeter defense duo in the league. But without Green out there, you really just have one guy to guard on the perimeter. You know, neither Tony Parker nor Patty Mills is really all that big of a threat defensively. Like, I feel like Steph can sort of have his way with whoever they put on him. You know, if they switch it with Kawhi on Steph, then all of a sudden you're letting KD or Klay Thompson go off. It just doesn't feel like they have enough to guard Golden State, at least not with Danny Green out.
Golden State last year, 59-45-2, best ATS record in the league against the spread. They were only plus 0.2 because their lines were so high. Notably, San Antonio was still top 10 in against the spread record, and they were plus 2.0, the best in the league versus the spread in terms of point swing versus the spread. So that feels notable here. I'll take the Warriors, but I would advise to stay away for this one in. Just because, I mean, man, KD at Oracle, I just think the place is going to be lit. It's going to be crazy. I have a hard time seeing San Antonio being able to hang without Danny Green. I think you're right. That shooting guard, the scoring from the wings, I think is going to be really difficult for them. That's Jared Dubin of CBS Sports Digital. Jared, thanks so much for joining me.
No problem, man. Thank you for having me.
All right, join me now on the CBS Sports NBA podcast. Tim Bontemps, Washington Post, longtime reporter and now national correspondent based in California, covering the biggest story in the NBA this year, the Golden State Warriors. Tim, thanks for coming on. What's it like? What's the circus level at there? Like, is it the biggest thing you've ever seen? Is it crazier than last year during the streak? What's the circus level at there?
You know, it's kind of funny. Everybody keeps asking me what it's like to be out here and what the atmosphere on the team is like. And honestly, it's been pretty boring. There really hasn't been a ton of attention paid to these guys here in the Bay Area. There's not really more people at practice than before. Today there was, I don't know, 7 or 8 reporters at practice, maybe. I mean, it's pretty standard number, and it's kind of been that way really all month. I mean, there were a lot of people at the first game in Vancouver because it was in Vancouver, and so people could go up to a cool city and see the Warriors play their first game. But otherwise, it's honestly been kind of low key. I mean, I think the one thing that people have underestimated about Durant coming to Golden State is that, A, like you said in your intro, last year the Warriors already were such a circus, it was going to be kind of hard to replicate or really exceed that anyway. And then on top of it, you know, this is a big market where there are 2 football teams and there were 2 baseball teams until a couple weeks ago. And, you know, there's even a hockey team. And so there's just a lot of other stuff happening. And so it's not that the Warriors aren't the biggest story here, because they are, but, and maybe it will change once the regular season starts. And, you know, I'm sure Tuesday when they play the Spurs will be crazy, and the Thunder the next home game the following week. I'm sure that will be crazy. But, you know, as far as the day-to-day people around the team and kind of the crush of media, it just hasn't – it really hasn't been any different than what it was before.
They're also really well prepped for it, too. I think that's part of it. Is like Ray Ritter does such a great job with their PR staff in terms of managing everything. Like, and their whole attitude, like the way that Kerr kind of keeps things very casual, like I think that that helps them with not getting affected by things. Like the Cavs were clearly kind of overwhelmed when LeBron came back and the kind of coverage that they got and just the immense just focus that that team kind of had to go through. Whereas the Warriors have kind of grown into this role and they're very well adapted for it. I think their facilities also help from an environment standpoint. So I think that they're well set up there. Preseason's over. Regular season is going to begin. They open versus the Spurs, who are without Danny Green. They are a big favorite, a 9-point favorite versus a team that won 67 wins last year, which kind of says how good this team is expected to be. I guess from the preseason, most everyone has kind of been just like, wow, that's been like the big takeaways. After the Raptors game, it's just generally been a sense of wow. Do you think they will be as good as we imagine them to be or better?
Yeah, I do. I don't know if they're going to win. I don't know if they're going to win more games or as many games as they did last year. I think that they could if they wanted to. I think they're probably going to try not to. Kind of actively, maybe in some instances, at least from the management and coaching standpoint. But yeah, I mean, they're going to be incredible. If you go back and watch even these preseason games, I mean, set aside, you know, like when they beat the Clippers by 50 in that first game back in Oakland a few weeks ago. But when Steph, Clay, and Durant are all on the court together and they get any kind of semi-transition or full transition break on offense, they get a wide-open three every single time. And that's not going to change. When you have three guys that are that good and they bring the ball up in transition, you can't find that many guys fast enough to prevent an open shot. And these guys are all going to make most of their open shots. So, you know, even in Friday's game, the last game of the preseason, they play Portland. Portland goes up 22-6 early. They come out. They're clearly trying to send a message. Look like they're, you know, trying to say that they're going to be a good team in the West this year. And I think they will be. But then the Warriors scored 6 points in 5 minutes. They then scored 84 points in the next 30 minutes. You know, it's like they're going to have runs like that just about every game. And, you know, if they're all healthy and on the court, I just think it's going to take a pretty Herculean effort for them to lose even one time, let alone several times.
So if they're going to be as good as we expect them to be, and they were already really great before, and you have relocated your entire life, moving from the East Coast to the West Coast for the first time ever, what are you going to cover? Like, Howard Beck and Zach Lowe talked about this on their podcast, and I thought it was an interesting question of, what are we going to... Because I'm really struggling with it. I don't know what to say about Golden State. Like, if they just do what we expect them to do, if they don't deviate from the norm, I'm having a hard time understanding what narratives, what analysis, what functions, what are the things that we're going to write about with this team? What is there to say?
Well, I think there'll be a lot to say. I mean, look, the first month or 6 weeks will inevitably have a few wild things happen, because if you go back and look at any of these teams early on, even if they're winning games, you know, weird things happen when these kind of groups come together and guys get used to each other. So you'll have that. But look, I mean, even if they are rolling through teams and winning a ton of games, I mean, even just that will be a story. I mean, if they're somehow on pace to exceed what they did last year, I mean, you know, that's going to be a total circus. And, you know, even though that probably isn't going to happen, you know, whenever they play the Clippers or the Cavs or, you know, the Spurs or some of these other really good teams, that'll all be a big event. When they play teams like the Jazz or the Blazers or the Wolves, some of these younger teams that are trying to maybe rise up another level and take them on, I think that'll be interesting. You know, they've obviously got the games in Oklahoma City. That'll be interesting. I mean, I think they're going to be the NBA's, you know, traveling, you know, Beatles tour, right? Or Springsteen tour, or whatever great band you want to think of. Like, every town they come into, that night it's going to be an event that, you know, really hasn't been like that since probably that first Heat team. And before that, maybe it wasn't like that since the Kobe and Shaq team, or even maybe the Jordan Bulls. Like, it's just going to be an event all the time. And I think, if nothing else, the event is going to be worth writing about. But I also think, you know, they're going to be fascinating to watch, even if it is just that they're doing stuff nobody's seen before. You know, I think that they'll be more than interesting enough for everybody to find ways to write about them. But as somebody, you know, like you said, somebody who's moved out here, you know, there's certainly a fun challenge in trying to find a way to write about this team in a way that other people aren't, when, you know, not only are there people like Zach and Howard who will come in and write things about them, you know, plenty, but there's a heck of a lot of people here who are really good, who are around them all the time, that that do a great job too. So it will be a fun challenge on that end for me, but I have a feeling that we're going to wind up having plenty to write about as the year goes on.
Anthony Slater moved out there. Chris Haynes moved out there. You've got all of these people that moved out there, and you've got people like Ethan Sherwood-Strauss, who, by the way, caused a bit of a stir this week with his article on ESPN. I wrote a little bit about the reaction from the Warriors to it, which I thought was very interesting, because there was a standard, like Steph did the, if you mess with Draymond, you mess with all of us line, which you kind of expected from Steph. I expected more of that from the rest of them, and instead what they were really mad about was that coward line. They were really ticked about the anonymous team source that said they played like cowards in Game 5 when Draymond was out. The bigger picture for me is this, is that when we're talking about like how this team operates, I started talking about this on Twitter the other night, I think it's fascinating that things get to them. Like, nothing bothered the Spurs with Duncan. Like, nothing. It doesn't matter what you said about them. You could do anything, and Tim Duncan would just be like, no, that's ridiculous. We're not going to talk about that. We're moving on. And Popovich would do the same, and Tony Parker would do the same, and even Manu, is as gracious as he is, would shut it down and move on. Versus the Warriors, like, things get to them. Like, they were really bothered last year by the stuff that went on with Draymond and LeBron. They've constantly been talking about all the disrespect that they got. They were bothered when the Bucks celebrated last year when they beat them, which is funny for a team that celebrates as much as they do. I think it's remarkable that they're able to be so bothered by things that go on and things get under their skin, and yet they still go out and annihilate teams. Like, that's one of the most impressive things to me, because they are not bulletproof by any sense of the word in terms of verbal assault, but they just are always so much better because of how gifted they are. I think that that's going to be an interesting thing to cover this year, because things just tend to get to them, from Steph throwing his mouth guard in Game 6 to everything that's gone on. Like, they are not a team that is unrattleable.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of that is true. I mean, look, the Spurs were bothered by things that were written throughout Duncan's tenure, but the Spurs did a masterful job of not ever saying that.
Right.
So, you know, I think there's a difference between not being bothered and not commenting. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the Spurs have always been kind of the masters in, you know, I think you called them a black curtain the other day and said a few franchises are like that. But they kind of, you know, like the Patriots, you know, Belichick is obviously bothered by things that are said about his team, I'm sure, all the time, given how prickly he is about things. But he doesn't ever let anybody know that. And that's kind of the beauty of what San Antonio's done. They don't, if something ever bothers them, you're never going to find out, which is almost more impressive, because it's a lot easier and frankly a lot more understandable to be what the Warriors have done this week. And if you see somebody calls you cowards, that you get your backs up. I wasn't that surprised by most of the reaction, though, to Ethan's story. I thought it was a very good story, but I also think it's a lot of stuff that was already kind of out there.
Right.
I don't think it was much of a secret back in May that Draymond was a little out of control during the playoffs. you know, and at times during the regular season, you know, that, you know, there certainly was a lot of coverage of that incident in Oklahoma City, you know, where he was going at Steve Kerr, and, you know, he obviously had the kicking incidents in the playoffs and throwing Michael Beasley to the ground, which I, in my opinion, is the dumbest, one of the three dumbest plays I've ever seen. You know, irregardless of what you think about what happened with Steven Adams and LeBron, if he hadn't just inexplicably body slammed Michael Beasley 75 feet from the basket at the end of a one game, at the end of a game, probably plays in game five anyway. So, you know, I was a little surprised they went so far in on the Coward stuff. And I think your point is accurate that they're not afraid to say when stuff bothers them. But I also think that, you know, if they come out this year and they romp and win 65 or 70 games and win the title, then, you know, I think they'll probably be fine. I mean, that Miami team with LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh, you know, they would get their backs up about stories all the time too. And that, you know, their process didn't get affected too much by it. So
true.
I think to back to your original point about the Spurs, I almost think all this is just more of a credit to Tim Duncan. And it's just another sign of just what an unbelievable leader that guy was for 19 years, that the Spurs, the entire time he was there, you know, even this month, right now there's LaMarcus Aldridge trade rumors out there. Like, that just wasn't the case. Like, stuff like that just never happened for his entire tenure.
Right.
And I think if you look at every other team in the league, I think it's just almost more remarkable how the Spurs have conducted themselves, that they just never had to deal with any of that stuff.
Outside of the big four, outside of KD, Steph, Draymond, and Klay, is there a player that you think will have a better and more impactful season than maybe people are anticipating for the squad? And is there a player that you think will probably take a step back maybe that people aren't really expecting?
Well, I mean, the thing about this team is I think, you know, I don't think they're like that Heat team because, in large part, because they have so much more depth. Like,
yeah,
you've got guys like Zaza Pachulia and David West and Andre Iguodala and Sean Livingston, like, all really good role players. But that Heat team, if you go back and look at that first Heat team, they had LeBron, Wade, and Bosch, and then they were starting guys like Eric Dampier and Jamal McGlure and Carlos Arroyo and Mike Bibby. Like, they just had horrendous players around them. And the fact that team won as many games as they did and were as good as they was, where it was even more remarkable given what those guys had around them. But I think there are questions about all of those bench guys. Probably not Livingston as much, but, you know, Zaza's getting up there in age. David West is, you know, in his late 30s. Andre Iguodala had back issues last year. You know, if all those guys are healthy and productive, and then, you know, the Warriors get a little help from some of their younger guys at the end of the bench, then they're going to just annihilate everybody. But I think if you are trying to find a weakness with this team outside of injuries to their main guys, it's that these rotation pieces they have around them all start to get old and start to take a step back. And then maybe, you know, if over the course of 82 games, these guys wear down a little bit and they get in the playoffs and it is a situation where, you know, those four guys don't have a lot of depth behind them, then maybe you could see somebody sneaking up on them, getting some trouble in the playoffs. But if that bench, if Zaza and David West and Iguodala all stay roughly where they were last year, the last couple of years, I mean, at that point, you're looking at, like, you know, does Kevon Looney become a rotation player? Or do Pat McCaw and Ian Clark both, you know, lock down these ninth and tenth rotation spots? And, like, does Ian Clark become the Howard Johnson of next summer? Like, that's kind of where you're getting to. But, you know, if those top eight guys are good, I just don't see how you beat this team.
Yeah, I don't either. I think Ian Clark could really benefit this year. He's a guy that I think could really establish himself. He's actually really pretty good, and he's got the trust of Steve Kerr, which I think goes a long way.
Yeah.
I think this might be a tough one for Iguodala. I haven't been around him to know, but I just know from when he was here in Denver, like, I know how prideful he is Like last year, he didn't want the Sixth Man of the Year award because he doesn't feel like he's a bench player. And, you know, it's one thing when you're like, well, we'll still find shots for Clay and we'll still find shots for Draymond. But, like, you literally just cannot have all of the shots that you used to have. Like, everybody's going to lose shots and they're not all going to come from Steph. So I think, you know, I think Iguodala is probably going to have the ball less and he's going to shoot less. Now, he may be a point in his career, but that's fine. And he may be totally okay with that. He's a guy, though, that, one, there were small moments last year. The overall defensive metrics were still terrific. He was still just, like, awe-inspiring. And when I went back and watched video on him, I'm still just like, God, he's just such a smart defender. But there were little moments where I was like, he's just like a half step slower than he used to be. Just a tiny, like, there were just small moments where he wasn't quite the defender that he used to be. And so I do wonder, like, how is that going to impact and what's his reaction going to be to that? So that he's one guy I do look at and say there could be kind of a step backwards. If anybody is going to take a step backwards, I think it's probably him. Because, like, Livingston is really just, like, a real manager, right? Like, make sure the offense works. If they're going to guard everybody else, he's going to post you up and he's going to hit that little short turnaround jumper that he's got, which is beautiful. Like, Livingston is like, Livingston's like, I almost lost my leg. I'm good just to be here. Like, he really is the just happy to be here guy. But I think Iguodala is one that he might struggle a little bit more with the adjustment to where he's coming from. Zaza will be a big question because he was so good in Milwaukee and Atlanta. He was terrific in Atlanta and really great in Milwaukee. And then under the radar last year, like in the playoffs, Carlisle wasn't playing him. Like, he was going with Mejri and other guys. So, like, this is going to be an interesting question of as much as it, as most of the Golden State media turns to, they just need to put in the death lineup. Play the death lineup more. Like, Kerr knows you can't do that. He cannot play that rotation for long periods of time because it just exhausts them to an unhealthy point. So I think Zaza is going to have to keep that up. How excited are you to cover, like, I was thinking about this, like, the guys you get to cover, like, outside of the big things, but, like, Draymond, there's always going to be something to ask about in, like, a controversy. Kerr is just really thoughtful and insightful. Like, he's just a really good guy to listen talk about anything with, Steve Kerr is. You've got Iguodala, you've got Sean Livingston, you've got David West, who is, like, a surly badass, but also has really great opinions and, like, just a really interesting dude on top of everything else. Like, you have a great collection of guys and JaVale McGee, but you have a great collection of guys there.
Well, that's kind of what I was getting at before. Like, when you were asking me, like, how are we going to write about this team? I just think there's just going to be interesting things going on all the time. Even if you're looking at, you know, a situation like, there's just some event in the news, right? Like, when these guys comment on stuff, that's going to be newsworthy. And you're right. Like, Sean Livingston, like, I covered him with the Brooklyn Nets. He's one of the more fascinating guys in the league, even just before you get to the story of, you know, kind of the way his career has progressed. Steve Kerr, one of the most thoughtful coaches in the league. You know, their whole roster, all the guys that play are all interesting in their own way, whether their path to where they got here or just as quotes. You know, there's just a lot of personality on this team, and you know, it is going to be very fun to kind of be around this group and see how everything unfolds and see how they adjust to being, you know, the team that they're hated in every arena they go to, which is not something that just about anybody on this team is used to or I think comfortable with. So I'm curious to see how they handle that. I mean, there's just a lot that's going to be going on and a lot of interesting guys to ask about it and talk to about it and go through it. So I really do think it's going to be fascinating. And I think, you know, anybody who's written about the Warriors on the internet, you and me included, knows that the interest hasn't dried up yet. And I don't think that it's going to stop anytime soon.
Do you expect them to win on Tuesday?
I expect them to win by a lot on Tuesday, actually. Okay. I think if Danny Green was playing, I would think that it'd be a pretty competitive game. But I think this is going to be a prime example of, you know, if, let's say they start Tony Parker and they're probably going to start Jonathan Simmons, I would guess. But right there, like, where are you putting Tony Parker on defense?
Right.
Like, right away, I don't know what they do with that. Like, I just think that it's going to be a good example of what a lot of these teams are going to run into, which is where you're going to have a hole on defense to guard. You know, maybe you can even guard two of those three guys. You're not going to be able to very – I don't know if any teams have three guys that can match up with all of them. So where are you putting everybody? Yeah. I mean, I think that's going to be – you know, I think that'll be a good example of where they go. And, yeah, I mean, they're the crowd here I think is going to be insane, and I think the Warriors are gonna get off to a good start.
And you'll be there to cover all of it. Tim Bontemps of the Washington Post, national reporter. Tim, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it, man.
Sure, Matt. Happy to do it.
All right. That was wrap it up for this edition of the CBS Sports NBA podcast. You guys can check us out on Stitcher and SoundCloud and all sorts of places. Leave us a review on iTunes. 5 stars, please. If not, if you don't like us, don't say anything at all. I'll be back later this week with more on the first week of coverage of the NBA 2016-17 season. Thanks, everybody.